Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is your non-denominational Christmas special of Science Weekly. Coming up on this extra special podcast, we'll take you back through our very best interviews of the past 12 months. You'll hear exclusive conversations with Richard Dawkins, Robert Winston, Craig Venter, and Brian May. Also in the show, we'll remind you of some of the year's most important science stories, and probably a few of the sillier ones too. Plus, the man who thinks he can cure the aging process. And we tried to get to the bottom of dark matter using the power of song. We don't really care if you've been naughty or nice. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Welcome back, dearest listeners, but in particular, season's greetings to all of you joining us for the very first time. Now, this is the place to come for the very best analysis of science, technology, and the environment, anywhere on the web. At least, that's what it says here. This is how it works. Every week, the science squad step into an airless room that we like to call the pod, and somehow conjure up an informed and entertaining half-hour of discussion on the week's science news. Helping me out with microphone duties is the Guardian science correspondent and amateur polemicist, James Randerson.
Give me some love.
Generally raising the tone is science daddy, Ian Sample.
Always a pleasure.
We also have the Guardian's tech correspondent, Big Bad Bobby Johnson.
You do not compute.
And making things altogether less masculine is Nell Bowes from the Guardian's arts team.
Aye, aye, Skipper.
Now, none of them are really here in the studio right now. It's just me and the man who's responsible for virtually all of the bad jokes, Science Weekly producer Ben Green, who sometimes speaks out loud. Like this.
Happy Winterval, one and all.
But mostly presses the buttons when we go from one section to another. A bit like this, in fact. Over the past year, we've brought you interviews with guests from around the scientific world. We've spoken to everyone from Nobel Prize winners to flirting experts, Arctic explorers to futurologists, heart surgeons to astronomers. But if there's one topic that's generated more response from our listeners than any other, it's been the intelligent design creationist evolutionist debate. In a moment, you'll hear from fertility expert Robert Winston about the subject. First, though, here's the man who managed to earn the nickname Darwin's Rottweiler. That's Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion.
On the one hand, when you talk to people like bishops, I find that I almost always agree with them, and it looks to me as though they don't really believe in a supernatural being, and yet they go on going to church and they go on reciting the creed and things. The sort of God that they believe in seems to be so wishy-washy, so sort of undefinable, so hard to get your hands on. It just sort of slips out of your fist like a slippery bar of soap. And so I don't know what they believe in. I was talking on the radio this morning to Robert Winston, who's a devout Jew. He goes to synagogue every week and observes the Sabbath and things. But when I said, Robert, I know you're observant and devout Jew, but I don't actually think you believe in God. And once again, it was very hard to get what he did. He said, well, it depends what you mean by God. And, well, what I mean by God is something supernatural, a supernatural intelligence who existed at the beginning of the universe and created the universe deliberately and has the sort of complexity, the sort of organization of a superhuman intelligence. Now, that's a very concrete thing. You either believe in it or you don't. I mean, you can be very uncertain about it, of course. There's no reason why you shouldn't be uncertain, but at least that's defined. You know what that is. It's something like a superhuman. It's something like a vast brain or a vast computer, the sort of thing that doesn't just spontaneously leap into existence, but needs an explanation.
Do you think that some of the reaction to your book, some of the negative reaction from people who say, well, look, this is a personal matter for me, my belief in God doesn't affect my daily life, do you think that's because you've asked the people to examine that relationship they might have with this, a questionable relationship they have,
yes,
might have with their God, and whilst they fly planes and take vaccines and so on, the sort of those two parts of their life have never had to be rationalised?
That's before. Right. I mean, I think there really is a mismatch between those two parts of their life, and I think that people who like to call themselves rational ought to face up to that. You can't just sort of sweep half your life into a separate corner and say, oh, well, that's the irrational part. I don't think about that. I switch off my brain when I come to that. I mean, of course, you're entitled to switch off your brain if you want to, but I think you need to face up to the fact that that's what you're doing.
But in a sense, you're forcing people into a corner to say, yes, I do believe that science is the way to explain the universe, and therefore I don't believe in God, or I believe in God and Can I not believe in science too?
Well, I wouldn't want to force anybody to say what they believe. I mean, I think you could very well say, I understand exactly what you mean by God, and I genuinely don't know whether there is one. I mean, that's an absolutely fine. But sort of to say, oh, you can't ask that question. Faith is protected ground. It's not a question you can ask. I mean, you do your science separately, but when it comes to faith, you suddenly switch off all your questioning faculties.
So do you think that the Bishop of Oxford and the Archbishop of Canterbury, those people are deluded?
I think they're wrong, but I wouldn't wish to use the word deluded in an insulting sense. I mean, I don't think they're insane.
And, how about in the sense of the book, the God Delusion?
Well, I merely think that it's a mistake, and I think it's wrong. I mean, I don't think that it's a delusion in the sense that an insane person is deluded that they're Napoleon or something of that sort.
Richard Dawkins there. Now, one of the people Dawkins got into a verbal scrap with in 2007 was Robert Winston, one of the UK's most popular scientists. Here he is speaking with Science Weekly's Nell Bowes.
What makes a good science communicator, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know some people who I would rate as very good science communicators. And I think what they tend to show is, first of all, a real passion for the subject. It's not something you can bolt on. That's why a number of actors have tried to be science communicators on television and in films, for example. I actually think that a good science communicator will tend to have a particular expertise in science too, because I think actually a lot of people can be communicators about anything. But I think, I mean, if I'm trusted by the public at all, I'm trusted partly because I think the public feel that I do know about the subject that I'm talking about and I've really explored it. And I think that is useful. And I think what's really important for so many of the people I've watched who I think are good science communicators and some of them are not, an attractive feature is, you know, a clear humanity. That I'm not saying I've got that, but one or two people who I admire, who I think are really good communicators, have that sort of human...
A sort of compassion? Or
yes, perhaps.
You're talking about science communicators, you're talking about a certain humility, and I guess the debate or the exchanges you've had with Dawkins recently kind of rears its head. did you think I was going to ask you about this or not? I did want to ask you one question about this, which is, when I spoke to Dawkins earlier, he said that your response to him, to his argument, was to say that offends me, and that wasn't a proper response. And I wondered if you agreed that that was your response.
Yes, I think it is a proper response. I think it is important to find things either offensive or have an emotional response to things, because actually that's what you have to do as a communicator, because that's what you're doing. You're doing that on behalf of the public. When I'm presenting stuff on television, I weigh up its emotional impact on behalf of other people. That's what I'm doing. I'm a channel. I'm a conduit for that. So I don't find... I'm surprised that he was angry at that. But he can't seem to understand why calling his book about a delusion, which is shared by a vast number of people, literally billions of people worldwide, many of whom are just as intelligent as we are, or indeed he is, probably more intelligent, some of them who are deeply moral, deeply valuable individuals, how you can actually accuse them of being deluded, misguided perhaps, but not deluded. That is very offensive language. And it's not a question of whether I find it offensive. It's because actually it's patently obvious that a large number of people find it offensive. One of the reasons, of course, why the book sells so well. Because, of course, if you have a good way of selling a book is to make it controversial. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good book or a good contribution to the literature. Now, in my view, Richard Dawkins is a fantastic writer. I think he's one of the best science writers in the world. Certainly, I think he's unparalleled in the English language. There's probably one other writer who I would put on a level with him, Matt Ridley, I think, who's very close, who I think is as valuable. But I think in this book, Richard actually has lowered his value. And I think that's a pity for him, because I think Richard is a good man. I think he's a nice man. I think he's much more spiritual than he appears to be. But he cannot get away unchallenged when he argues, for example, that the God of the Bible is malign or is aggressive, because in fact actually what the Bible is doing is showing a set of values which are way in advance of their time. You know, we're talking about 4,000 years ago, And the idea that you could have a system of justice, a system of equal representation for people, system of democracy before Greece, all of that is in the Old Testament. That's just one example. It's extraordinary to think that here is, you know, the God of the Israelites saying, you must rest on the Sabbath day, not just you, but the non-Jews, and your animals. You mustn't work your animals. And you've got to treat your animals with compassion. Which other community in the world said that or wrote that down? There is a strong feeling of humanity about that. And Richard doesn't even remotely acknowledge that in any of the things that he writes. And he argues that religion is divisive, corrupting, immoral, and damaging. And that is not true.
Robert Winston. You can hear full interviews with Dawkins and Winston and a whole host of others as part of our extended Science Extra downloads. Head back to iTunes or guardian.co.uk/science for more info. Back in October, we brought you a series of exclusive conversations with Craig Venter, a controversial man but deeply interesting to boot. The Vietnam vet and former surfer has spent the last 20 years cultivating a bad boy reputation, most famously by racing to sequence the human genome, and then, earlier this year, becoming the first human being to publish their own DNA code. The Guardian's Ed Pilkington spoke to Venter in New York and began by asking if he was nervous about mapping his own genes, and therefore getting a glimpse into his own future.
Being able to predict and know the exact day you're going to die, I'm not sure that's such a horrible thing. I mean, it's part of what I've argued is that if people really knew that this is our finite time, this is our existence between the beginning and whenever we die, that's our time to make a contribution.
So you feel you could cope with that information? Obviously, you don't have it, and you won't have it for many years, but if it does ever become possible, you could cope with that.
I would like to know it, actually.
You would actively like to know that?
Yeah. I may not tell my family if I know. It depends what the news is, right? but I would like to know that. You know, genetics give us odds, right? You want to find a way to beat the odds. You know, the genetic code will never tell us, you know, I don't care when it is in the future, it won't tell us the day or the year that we're going to die. It will tell us that we have bigger risk for certain things. In fact, knowing of those risks, what I like is it gives me the ability to do something about it.
Right. So let's run through some of those things. Okay. I mean, you mentioned a few in your book, and maybe there's the more that you haven't written in the book. The obvious one is the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking statins.
Yes.
And you're exercising and you've got a diet.
You know, that's one of the ideals is as we get information about our own metabolism, our own lives, that I don't think there'll be customized medicines for us. But there should be customized diets. You know, we are also environmental animals as well as genetic animals, and so a diet that works for me may not work for you.
In terms of the other things that your genome reveal a slight proneness to, just rattling through them, alcoholism, risk of blindness you mentioned, and dementia, all those areas, as you say, are so poorly understood, there's nothing that you've been able to do bar drinking less, perhaps. The other one I found really intriguing was the ADHD part of the genome, which sort of kind of fits your memories of your childhood about being a quite sort of vivacious, hyperactive kid. And you have a line in the book in which you say, you know, nowadays you'd be on Ritalin.
Yeah.
And actually that opens a thought for me because, you know, come the day when the genomes are common, individual genomes are common and actually better understood than they are now, it is possible that children may be found to have ADHD genetic characteristics, and there are drugs to treat that to cope with the symptoms. Now, it made me wonder, would you have gone on to do whatever thing you've done if you hadn't been a very hyperactive, slightly troubled, kind of slightly manic kid?
It's a great question, and there's a definite danger. I think there's a danger in too many kids being on Ritalin anyway, but... We have this certain regimentation with education system in general that is, you know, my genetic code didn't fit in well with the education system that was designed mainly for rote memorization of things. And perhaps if I was put on Ritalin, I would have done much better in my first 12 years of school and probably been
better. And you'd be an accountant right now.
Yeah, that possibly.
Yeah. Craig Venter. That interview is also available in full as a Science Extra. Now, Craig Venter's not the only controversial scientist who's been in the pod in the past 52 weeks. In February, we welcomed Aubrey de Grey to our soundproofed former broom cupboard. You may have heard of Aubrey before. He's the man who argues that ageing is a disease that can be cured, and we should all be living up to a grand old age of 1,000. Incidentally, he's also the owner of a more impressive beard than a certain Mr. S. Claus. Here he is anyway, speaking to me and James Randerson.
Aging is actually not a particularly exciting phenomenon. It's simply a decay phenomenon. It's the accumulation of damage in the same way that any machine, like a house or a car, would accumulate damage.
What kind of damage are you talking about?
And this is the point. The stage we've got to now is that we can actually answer that question reasonably well. We can actually describe at the molecular and cellular level the various types of damage that accumulate. Things like, for example, cells dying and not being naturally replaced. Things like mutations accumulating in our chromosomes and also in a special part of the cell called the mitochondrion. Things like the accumulation of indigestible molecules of various sorts in the interior of a cell and also in the spaces between cells.
Why the 1,000 years figure? I mean, is it just a convenient figure? Because, I mean, presumably if you can stop these processes of decay, is there any reason why we couldn't live forever?
Not at all. The 1,000 years is purely an average. It's just like a half-life, really. If we look at the rate at which people die from causes that have nothing to do with ageing, whether like homicide or accidents or whatever, and we ask how long would people live if that was all they were dying of, then people have done this calculation many times, and you get different answers depending on different data, of course, but roughly it's around 1,000 years.
Aubrey, just finally, can I ask you, what about this is all very technical and how to sort of get rid of waste products in our blood and so on. But what about the sort of societal aspects? If we're all living huge lives, 1,000 years and so on, won't there be just too many people?
Absolutely. I regard it very much as part of my job to consider the social context of this work as well as the science. And overpopulation is probably the question that comes up most often. My view is very straightforward. I think that over the long term, we will indeed have to equalise the birth rate and the death rate, and therefore society will, in a post-aging world, have a choice, either to use these therapies and have everybody living a very long time with a low death rate, and to balance that by having very few children, or alternatively to reject the use of these therapies, and because if we think that children are really important to have a lot of around, then to do that. What I say that we have to think now, however, is that the question is who should be making that choice, and for me it's very straightforward, that the people of the future have the right to make that choice for themselves, rather than to have our choice imposed on them by our hesitation in not developing these therapies in the first place.
Hi folks, this is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
He's right, you know, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha, and we're over halfway through this special edition of our almost award-winning show. Now, you may be wondering what Brian May's doing on a science podcast, and you'd be right, sort of. Brian's, of course, best known for his epic guitar solos with Queen, not to mention his luxurious locks. But this summer, Brian put down his guitar for long enough to hand in his PhD thesis to Imperial College in London. It had the snappy title, Radial Velocities in the Zodiacal Dust Cloud, and producer Ben went along to see him in his gown to find out more.
In the solar system, there are planets, and there are asteroids, and there are comets, and there is also a lot of dust. We call it the Zodiacal Dust Cloud because it mainly lies in the plane of the zodiac, which is the perceived line which the sun travels along as we travel around the sun. So what I did in the 1970s was look at the dust with a spectrometer and look for Doppler shifts in its spectrum. Its spectrum is just reflected sunlight. So if you compare the spectrum of the piece of dust you're looking at with the spectrum of the sun, you ought to be able to see shifts, and that's what we did. So the more the shift, the more the radial velocity, the relative velocity between us and the piece of dust. So the idea was to try and map the motions of this dust.
Now, you mentioned there that you began this back in the 70s, so this really has been a labour of love over 30 years.
Yeah, I had a long gap here. I mean, I was away for quite a while. But yes, it is a labour of love. I really had a strong call to go back to this, having left it almost finished, tantalisingly almost finished in 1974 when we started off going around the world as Queen. It's been a thrill to get back to it. It's also been very tough. There's been moments where I wanted to give up, I have to tell you honestly, because it is tough writing any kind of dissertation, thesis or whatever. You get to points where you think, ah, why did I do this? Why did I commit to this awful bit of work? You know, there are points where you can see no light at the end of the tunnel, and I had a couple of those. But in the end, I'm thrilled that I got there. I had some great help, some great inspiration. I had the head of astrophysics of Imperial College as my personal supervisor, who's been monumentally tough on me, but that was what I needed. I needed it to be gold standard. I needed it to be you know, I don't want any favours done to me. This is not an honorary thesis, an honorary PhD. This is the real thing.
Would you say that your science and your interest in that has influenced your music in any way? I mean, I would say that Radial Velocities in the Zodiacal Dust Cloud sounds like an absolutely great song title, particularly for a death metal album.
Yeah, it has a certain ring to it, doesn't it? It's a rhythm. Not directly very much is the answer. I don't know if you know, but I did write a song about a song called 39, which chronicles the adventures of an explorer in space, and because of the general relativistic time dilation effect, he returns to Earth a year older, but his family are all gone because it's been 100 years on the Earth. And I was very touched by that sort of scenario and wrote the song about it. That's the closest that I've come, I suppose, to an astronomical theme for a song. Mainly my songs are about feelings and people and relationships. But there is a great relationship, I think, between astronomy and music, which has always been there. A lot of the great astronomers have been musicians and vice versa. Don't know why that should be exactly, but there does seem to be a similar kind of harmony which you seek in both. I don't know if I can put it any more succinctly than that, but astronomy and music definitely go together, just as Patrick Moore's introduction to his Sky at Night always moves you to contemplate the heavens. There is something that inside us gets triggered, I think, by music and astronomy, sort of contemplating the infinite, I suppose.
If you were given the choice of a guitar or your telescope, what would it be?
Oh, a choice of one? That would be very difficult. That would be too hard.
I guess what I'm essentially saying is music or science.
I hope I never have to make the choice again. I think it's, you know, we're sitting, I'm avoiding the question here, you'll notice, but we're sitting in the Imperial College of Science and Technology, which is a huge campus here, and it was all laid out by Prince Albert for arts and sciences. The Royal College of Music sits right in the middle, still, and there's engineering here, there's biology, there's science, and there's music, and originally there was quite a bit of art as well. I think that schools in general tend to make us specialise too much, and I feel like I'm holding a banner for the fact that you can be broad and you can be passionate about more than one part of the pursuit of knowledge or the pursuit of art, however you want to look at it. I like the fact that I perhaps seem to have chosen music over science, but it was never gone from my insides. It was always there. I was always very, very keen. So I'm very lucky that I can do both now.
Brian May there. Believe me when I tell you that we'd been trying to get him on the show ever since we launched in 2006, so we were very, very pleased with that interview. If there's anyone you want to hear on the show in the forthcoming year, email science@guardian.co.uk and tell us your darkest desires. It's at this point in the show that we normally present you a roundup of the rest of the week's science and tech news. But this being our Christmas special stroke end of year review, we thought we'd bring you a specially extended version of some of the biggest and, all right, silliest science stories of the past 12 months. Here's Nell, Bobby, James, Ian and producer Ben with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Autism-like behaviour in children is linked to the amount of testosterone they receive whilst in their mother's womb. That's according to a long-term study of behavioural changes in children carried out by scientists at Cambridge University. The research provides support for the theory that neural changes predisposing a child to autism happen while its brain is developing in the womb, and that autism is the result of a so-called extreme male brain.
The government should reconsider its decades-long ban on sending Britons into space, according to MPs. They warn that an outright rejection of human spaceflight will lead to the UK being unable to take part in future international missions and weaken the country's standing in space science.
Smoking cannabis increases your risk of schizophrenia by at least 40%, according to a study in The Lancet. Researchers said that there are at least 800 people suffering serious psychosis in the UK after smoking the drug.
10 years after creating the first real-life Mighty Mouse, scientists have unveiled an even mightier version. In 1997, they produced beefed-up mice that lacked the gene for myostatin, which limits muscle growth. In the latest research, the team found that boosting the levels of another protein, follistatin, doubled the muscle-making effect.
NASA plans to build on Einstein's legacy by researching some of the most exotic phenomena in the universe. The Einstein Probes Office was set up last week to coordinate 5 missions to study dark energy and black holes and hunt for clues to the origin and evolution of the universe, areas of physics where Einstein's general theory of relativity has been hugely important.
And finally, psychologists have shed light on one of the most enduring mysteries of human courtship, why men persist with chat-up lines that send most women running for the high hills. A survey revealed that women were more likely to favour lines suggesting that a man was a nice guy, whereas men were always over-optimistic that women would find them irresistible if their opening gambit was sexually explicit.
And finally, archaeologists believe they have solved the mysterious death of Otzi, the famous 5,000-year-old mummified iceman from Austria. Until now, nobody knew what killed the chilly chap. But new analysis has revealed that he bled to death after being... Sorry.
Who wrote this?
I did. I just wanted to call him a chilly chap. What's wrong with that?
Well, there...
I thought it would be amusing, and it was. Unfortunately, now I can't stop laughing.
Very funny.
And finally, archaeologists believe they've solved the mysterious death of Otzi, the famous 5,000-year-old mummified iceman. Until now, nobody knew what killed the chilly chap. Okay. Until now, nobody knew what killed the chilly chap, but new analysis has revealed that he bled to death after being shot through the shoulder by an arrow. Austrian police have not commented on whether they intend to open the cold case. I thank you.
Whatever your view on any of the stories we cover, don't forget you can always add your thoughts. All you have to do is head to the Science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. And because we're so down with the kids, you can also join our Facebook group and leave a message on the wall. Search for the I Listen to the Guardian Science podcast next time you log on. Now then, one of the stories mentioned in that review was the news that smoking cannabis increased the risks of developing schizophrenia. Well, one of the most interesting moments in Science Weekly this year was when our man James Randerson volunteered to take part in a clinical trial to investigate the impact of THC, that's the main psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, on the human brain. He was in the presenter's chair that week, and here's how he got on. The other voices you'll hear are Professor Paul Morrison from King's College London, who was leading the study, and back in the pod, Bobby Johnson.
Yeah. I think something's happening.
Yeah.
I feel like I've got a big grin on my face.
Yeah,
I've definitely got a big grin on my face.
It's kind of getting a false. Quite enjoyable.
Yes. Yeah, now, how can I describe this? There's a kind of warm feeling in my stomach, I guess. And I feel quite lightheaded. Yeah, it feels like... I think I can feel my heart, so yeah, it feels like maybe my heart rate has increased.
Okay. Has the experience changed in intensity?
Sometimes I have moments when I think I'm starting to come down, but then they sort of go away again, or I look at something else or something.
Yeah. I think we've just got one cognitive test to go, actually. Were you enjoying the cognitive test?
Well, I wouldn't say I was enjoying them, though. They required a lot of concentration. I seem to remember on the AB one there last time there was quite a hardcore time limit.
Yeah.
But you didn't mention it.
You got
seemed to get to the end of it.
You got well within the time. You were finished with 30 seconds to go.
Oh, really? Because last time, I think I was right up against the wire, I think, just as I finished.
Oh.
Someone said stop, so which makes me think that those answers aren't that accurate, probably.
We'll see.
I expect, stone people must be really boring to listen to.
They certainly are, and that's the first time I've listened to that since yesterday, and I'm glad to hear that any professional credibility that I may once have had has now entirely evaporated.
Are we assuming that you had some in the first place there, James?
Yeah.
We heard Paul say that he couldn't predict whether you were going to experience any psychosis. We did all kind of chuckle there, I think, at the idea of you suddenly going loopy on us. But what happened?
Well, I think I was quite fortunate. I mean, some of the questions he was asking were things like, is someone controlling your mind? Can you see your thoughts in front of you? Are objects around the room controlling your thoughts? Is this a setup of the experimenters, doing things with your brain, that kind of stuff? I didn't answer yes to any of them because my experience was sort of, 98% pleasurable. I mean, there were kind of slight moments of paranoia, but generally it was very pleasurable. But he said that, you know, that there's been a great variety of reactions amongst the people there. Some people that he's had in there have been totally paranoid and had, you know, really not a very pleasurable experience at all.
What are they actually trying to achieve by doing it, apart from giving you a good day out?
Well, that was actually the second of two sessions. And one of them, they give you the drug. The second one, or the other one, they give you the placebo. And it's a double-blind trial, so neither of you knows for sure, although it was pretty obvious to me. And then they do these cognitive tests, which are quite hard. You know, it's naming as many words as you can, beginning with the same letter, giving you a list of sort of 20 words, getting you to learn them, and then asking you in 20 minutes how many you can remember, trying to kind of remember lists of playing cards and things like that. Really hard stuff. The weird thing was that I actually did better on two of the tests, two out of three tests, when I was on cannabis, which was quite strange. I'm not sure that was what...
We'll try and bring that in as a work policy, then, shall yeah. we, to sharpen up all of our attempts at writing. What are the... We've talked before about, you know, the scaremongering in the press about super skunk that's a thousand times more powerful than it was 10 years ago. What was the kind of dosage of THC that you were...
Well, I mean, he billed it to me as sort of... It's 2.5 milligrams of THC, which he billed as sort of the amount in a strong joint. But, I mean, it was a very, very intense experience. And I suspect that the reason for that is that, you know, mainlining it is very different than smoking it.
You're still suffering, aren't you?
I have been slightly slow on the uptake today, I must admit, yeah.
Conclusive proof again, kids. Just say no. OK, if this programme was live, our mums would be calling us down for Christmas lunch by now, but we can't go without introducing you to a very special guest. Science Weekly is the only podcast in the iTuneverse with our very own troubadour, the highly talented and supremely bearded Johnny Berliner. He likes to give us his unique take on the things that just can't be resolved by conversation alone. Take, for example, dark matter. This is the substance that's never been seen but accounts for almost all the mass in the universe. And because it doesn't emit or reflect light, scientists have never observed it directly. All in all, then, the perfect subject for a song.
You look up at the sky at night, you're seeing a mystery. The physicists are in a twist about the forming of the galaxies. It's a very heavy issue, it's an issue of gravity. It's a dark, dark matter. 'Cause there needs to be a substance that we're just not detecting. But it's hard to find material that just ain't reflecting. Or maybe it's our theories just need some correcting. It's a dark, dark matter. So what does it feel like and how does it smell? If you had some in a bucket, how could you tell? Could you sit on it or sculpt it or eat it as well? It's a dark, dark matter. No, they haven't got a clue what the stuff consists of. It's not made from any particles that they have a list of. And now it's really pissing all the cosmologists off. It's a dark, dark matter. So what does it feel like and how does it smell? If you had some in a bucket, how could you tell? Could you sit on it or sculpt it or eat it as well? It's a dark, dark matter. And it's a dark matter. Yeah, what does it feel like and how does it smell? If you had some in a bucket, how could you tell? Could you sit on it or sculpt it or eat it as well? It's a dark, dark matter. Well, they found that finding evidence was fairly demanding. It stretched us to the limits of our understanding. Then it opened up a can of worms about why the universe is still expanding at an accelerating rate. It's a dark, 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 dark matter!
The genius that is Johnny Berliner. armchair philosopher and Science Weekly's troubadour. You can find out more about him at myspace.com/Johnny Berliner. And that's Johnny without an H and Berliner like Ich bin ein, or donut in fact. Okay, folks, that's it for the Christmas stroke Winterval special. We hope you've enjoyed your trip down memory lane, or even better, that you've found your first ever half hour in the company of the Science Weekly team, warm and cuddly, and equal parts entertaining and informative. We'll be back on January the 2nd with a special look ahead to the science of 2008. Look out too for our new spin-off shows in the new year, Technology Weekly and Environment Weekly, all part of an excellent new winter lineup. In the meantime, why don't you check out our archive at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts and listen to some of our pods from the past. You'll find interviews with the likes of philosopher A.C. Grayling, physicist Jim Al-Khalili and a very, very sweary Steven Pinker. You can even hear a long-running debate on tea, a haiku on climate change, a few crude sound effects and occasionally some tasteless gags. For now though, podders, let me tell you that Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green and I've been Alok Jha. Ho, ho, ho!
Guardian Unlimited.